Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to episode 123 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary British musician Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. Now, on this episode of the podcast, a man that Uncut magazine called Liverpool's answer to Dr. John. Musician, singer, songwriter Edgar Jones is my very special guest. From the stairs to solo, we hear about it all. Now, Edgar was also part of the Paul Weller live band around Heliocentric, playing bass during that time. In fact, he appears on the Live at the Royal Albert Hall DVD recorded in 2000. Noel Gallagher called his debut solo album Soothing Music for Stray Cats one of the best records that he's ever heard. This is another very special guest on the podcast. Let's get into it. Edgar Jones, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I want to kick off with a question from Twitter. Matthew Walsh says, should you call him Edgar Jones or Edgar Summertime? And I'll add to that, because there's also Edgar Summertime Jones, there's Edgar Joan Jones. What should it be?
I have many names. This has been discussed about the new record that's coming out, and we've decided that from now on I'm just playing old Edgar Jones.
Cool.
it's up to me not to make that plain, you know.
I tell you what, this is pretty exciting, because just literally minutes before this chat, you messaged me on WhatsApp, which is exciting enough, to be honest with you, but you messaged me with news of a new single, which you've shared. It's either an A and B side or a double A, you're not quite sure, right?
I kind of wrote the song, you know, when you're a fan of vinyl, you think of these idyllic B-sides, you know, which is The Plague by Scott Walker on Flipper Jackie. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's my favourite example of like a B-side. You know, it's a bit weird. It's a bit left field, even for a left field artist, you know what I mean? And wrote that song, you know, it's discordant and all that, like The Plague is. But that's about as close to The Plague as it is. Yeah, so it's that kind of thing, you know, where... But one of the guys in the setup, he's not got as many singles as some of the others. He says, no, it should be an A-side. I'm like, no, it's not. You know, it's not calling it bad names, calling it a B-side. It's like bigging it up. It's that thing, you know, you'd have to have a chunk of small vinyl to understand.
To understand what you're at, yeah. Well, you and Paul have that in common, definitely, the love of the B-side.
Oh,
it's definitely a trait as well, right? So look, this is really exciting having you on. We'll talk more about this single. We'll talk more about the new album that's on the way. I can't wait to find out more about that as well. And we talk about Paul being a chameleon, Paul Weller being a chameleon, and going where the music takes him. I mean, goodness me, you have so much in common there. We'll run through some of that stuff in our chat as well. But first of all, I want to talk about, when was it you first became aware of the music of Paul Weller? Would it have been the Jam, the Style Council, at the end of your world?
Yeah, very young, because I was when I first became aware of the Jam, really, my brother brought David Watts on. My brother was like 6 years older than me, so now I was 8 or 9, he was like 14, 15, digging all the punk records and new wave that was happening at the time. And he brought David Watts on, and I was sort of like, you know, watching him, Paul going round to it in the living room, going, oh, what's this? This is interesting. Yeah, they just kept making great records, so, they did, you know. Not taking any away from the other two. Like, they made, you know, great records for a number of years after that, like, wasn't it? So, so very young, I became aware of Mr. Weller, like, yeah.
And it seems to me that your music tastes, because of the music that you give us, it seems to me your music tastes are very eclectic, and much like Paul, whereby you're happy to kind of indulge in anything and everything. Just if you like it, it doesn't matter whether it's jazz, soul, funk, or whatever else. So were the Style Council a thing in your world? Because that was very much them trying different things as well.
Yeah, I loved that first album. I'd have been sort of like the middle towards the end of secondary school when that came out. Yeah, I loved the first one. I kind of lost track of them as the LPs came out. So it was mostly aware of the singles later on. I think I was just delving my head so deep into the past, you know, that I wasn't aware of what albums they were bringing out. But obviously, you couldn't miss the singles because they were everywhere and they were great.
Now, this kid at school obviously has a love of music, the love of the past that you talk about. But when was it you kind of picked up a guitar and figured out that you could do this thing? How did you pick up and what were you learning first? Was it the bass, the acoustic, or what?
It was just guitar, really. I had one bought for me when I was about 14. Dabbled on them and made noises on them previously to that. To this day, really. You know, me get the guitar player, I don't rate myself, you know. I've mostly learnt in order to be able to knock out chords so I can knock out songs. Knocking out songs is my main interest, really. You know, if I had to pack in everything bar one thing, the one thing I'd stay doing is the songwriting.
And does that start with lyrics, or does that start with a tune in your head, or...?
It can start with many ways, lad. Yeah, it can come from a riff. It can come from a little tune in the head. It can come from a bass line. The muse is very naughty, though. One thing I will say it often does is I'm usually meant to be somewhere else when one of these ideas comes through. The amount of times I've thought of a great bass line before I'm meant to be leaving the house to DJ in 5 minutes, or, you know, or what, you know what I mean? It's like the amount of times that's happened, lad. I can't see.
Well, you have like occasions where maybe you're not present in the moment because actually your head's taking you off into this world of creating a song or a lyric or whatever.
Yeah, it's just naughty. It just likes to make me late to things.
Now, I mentioned that you were coming on, and so many people went, oh my God, The Stairs. You have to ask me about The Stairs. What a band. And for a band that had such a short period of time, and I know you've had the odd reunion, another one coming soon, which we'll chat about in a sec, but a short period of time, that band means a lot to people, doesn't it?
It does an awful lot, like. It's kind of, until we did the reunion, I didn't know, because, you know, you always go on silly things like sales, and I know that the album didn't sell out, kind of thing, you know what I mean? It didn't chart, so I'd always presume that, you know, but I suppose just the myth and the legend built over years, like, we were a bit different.
And it's interesting how that started, because it was a connection. Was it you and Paul Maguire both in the same youth training scheme? Was that right?
Training scheme, yeah. And Jed had been there the year previous, so he used to come down to see his mate who was still in there, you know, just like hanging out. We had a mate, Pete Baker, who was also there, who was in the band originally. It just ended up us getting together in Pete's flat, and one night me and Jed had the jam that went on for about an hour. And everyone was like, oh yeah, sound that, like that, you know, we had the fucking little tape of it, like, and everyone was burning the tape out for a week or two, this little thing that we'd done, like, and we just took things from there. And on the scheme, I'd been, you know, there was a music room, and I was always bunking off up there, and quite often seeing Paul there, we'd knock stuff out there, like, and that, you know.
It was music related, was it? Or were you meant to be doing something else?
It was called Liverpool Youth Music Project. You had to take a module like electronics or woodwork, which was a guitar making workshop, which I should have done, really, thinking back. But I did electronics because you got 2 months in a recording studio. And it's the legendary studio where Lee made the 4-track demos that, you know, were unrepeatable to him. A lot of the kids weren't really interested, you know, in the studio side of it for some reason. So when the lads came back in, because I was always trying to get in there to do that instead of electronics, I got to engineer the lads for a few days, and that was how I got to know Lee. He used to call me Sucker Banger, because, yeah, it was everywhere. He thought it always just like I'd be sucking on a banger.
Brilliant. Well, we'll talk more about the lads. I want to come back to that in a sec. But the first Weller connection that I can find is that band, because you're label mates. So you get signed to Go Discs. Yeah. And we should talk about Andy McDonald, who I'd love to get on the podcast, but seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. We reckon he's bought a desert island or something somewhere in the Caribbean. I don't know. You were label mates. Did it mean that you'd cross paths in the corridor at any point or other things like that, or not really?
We'd heard something from the Japanese company that one of the reasons Paul went with Go Disc was because, you know, they were putting good music out by Lars and ourselves. And, you know, and they were, Lee's a difficult egg at times, like, you know, and they were, you know, letting them do the album again and again and stuff like that. And, you know, I believe, you know, I was told that, but I don't know if it's, you know, absolute gospel truth or anything. Yeah, we were one of the reasons he went there. When he actually got signed to the label, we were kind of in limbo because our key man, Chaz Smash, he'd kind of like left the label because Madness had reformed. So we were kind of in limbo when Paul had joined the label. I remember being given the Sunflower single. Yeah.
Nice. The little freebies would have been great. Yeah. And Billy Bragg was on that label at the time as well.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Yeah. Never saw Billy. They were actually like, it was mostly Trash Cans. We used to see a lot of them. See a lot of the Trash Cans. Yeah.
And what was the relationship with Andy McDonald like? So the record label boss?
Carl had to fight him a little bit. You know, I don't think he saw the same in us as Carl did, but you know, he came round. He came round in the end. We were just a bunch of teenage nightmares.
Yeah, I mean, you were kids, right? What, you like 19, 20 or something?
20, yeah, when we got signed. Yeah, right.
There's this debut single, Weed Bus, which actually thinking about it, didn't Steve Wright start playing this?
He did for about 3 weeks till he realised what it was about. It was sad really, because it was climbing up the charts every week, and then all of a sudden blackballed by the industry for life.
So yeah, the day of recording today is Steve Wright in the Afternoon's last day on Radio 2 after what, 25 years or something ridiculous. But this would have been like Radio 1 day, so this would have been, was he on Breakfast maybe at that point? Was he on?
I don't know.
Early 90s, wasn't it? So
yeah, I think, you know, it might have been after, I don't know, it was in morning or afternoon, I can't remember now actually.
Yeah.
It always seemed like he was on all day. He always had David Bowie telling you the time and nothing.
And then this album, Mexican R&B. Now, I've got a note here that I have to ask you about, right? So I mentioned to a good friend of the podcast, Neil Jones from Stone Foundation, that you were coming on, right? And you supported Stone Foundation on their Everybody Anyone tour a few years back. And first of all, he says, A, you're a really nice guy, so please say hello from him. So I've done that. And he said that the reason they wanted to invite you to, they were massive fans of that record, that Mexican R&B. And so he said to me, ask him about the cover of that record. It's a really funny story.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is. The one that you see in the, you know, on the album to this day was our second attempt at making the album sleeve. We knew that we wanted the whole thing with the Mexicans, and I wanted the donkey there, and Jed wanted to be different and wear a spacesuit. So the first attempt, we went to the donkey rather than bringing the donkey to us. So we went to this, it was in the middle of the tour, and we found the donkey sanctuary somewhere en route in the middle of the tour, and went to have our photo taken with the donkey at the sanctuary. But one, the weather was terrible. Two, the costumes were like, and like Jed's spaceman suit looked more like he was going to be fired out of a cannon. You know, it was like a child. silver salopettes and a cape and a little mustache. I mean, like you do, on, I think on one of the Viper releases, some of the photos we took ourselves on the day. And actually, there is a Stairs release that's meant to be happening. So Ian Tilton, if you're out there, you still have those shots, because we were looking to see if he still exists, but, you know, because with the guy Heavy Soul, he's Adam Lovely Geezer, he's putting out his Stairs comp license from Jerry Red. So Ian Tilton, if you're out there, that shot still exists. Yeah, you can probably brighten up on the computer now. It was a horrible day, but second attempt was cool. We did it in a London film studio, you know, donkey that was more famous than us. It was the Lumpali donkey, and that was a real Moonraker spaceship that Jed's steaming up there.
Brilliant. I love it. Now, I mean, it was fair to say, I mean, it was quite a volatile band. The relationships weren't always firing in the right direction, right?
No. There was a bit of a revolving door, mostly around Jed and Jason's side of the band, yeah.
So what brought you back together? I mean, we're talking like what, like 20, 25 years later, you came back together for that reunion, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was just because we asked them the time scene, right? And there was a great venue in Liverpool called the Casimir, which we knew was shutting down towards the end of the year. It was a number of factors that brought it all together. A lot has to be said for the Wicked Whispers. They played an absolutely massive part in that. Still thank them to this day for that.
And more to come. We'll talk about that in a second. But as this is the Paul Weller Fan Podcast, I'd love to know when your first real connection with Mr. Weller was.
I passed him really cross until I came to audition for him.
Wasn't there a support slot with Lee Mathers and Weller? Were you part of that?
No. I never actually got to hit the stage with Lee. No. It was like a year spent in rehearsals, you know. Small percentages of that year were actually spent playing, you know.
So let's talk about the connection with Weller then. So in terms of that audition, because just before that, you'd been part of Johnny Marr's band. You'd been part of that original iteration of the Healers, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, in between sort of like that and St. Etienne. It was kind of a you know, a work in process, in progress, sorry, the Healers, when I was doing it. He was trying things out, feeling his way around different musicians. It seemed to be always me and Zach Starkey. It was just a thing where, you know, we'd go along to his whenever our schedules would, whenever the stars of the line, you know, and just make some music.
And you just spend like all day jamming, right?
Yeah. Some great stuff. You know, we went through the whole gamut of different types of stuff. You know, there's a bit of funk, a bit of soul, a bit of rather heavy stuff that some people would be surprised that Johnny Marr partaking of. It was all great. We were having great fun. And, After a while, Johnny just got on the writing muse, really. You know, I think a few things that were happening around the time, like, you know, he was into the, you know, the bringing technology into it. But that was all around the time, the Beko delay album, so a lot of people were trying to, you know, head things off that way. And yeah, just the muse hit him hard, and we didn't have no material. And then sort of almost overnight, like he seemed to have an album written. Like, so it's like, okay, let's go. It was a lot of waiting around. So when Paul gave the call and I knew it was for touring and stuff like that, it was like, oh, I want to get out there and do some stuff. Saint Etienne were great as well, but didn't go out very often, you know, and yeah. I wanted to get out there.
There's a great quote. Andy Pickle on Twitter says that Edgar was working with Johnny Marr on stuff when he got the call to join Paul Weller. He said it was like leaving Coronation Street to join EastEnders.
Yeah, it was, mate.
I like that.
Has anyone ever done that? I don't know. My mate Chris Healy, he left Hollyoaks Brookside to join Hollyoaks. And actually played the same character in both, which is weird.
Brilliant. I did not know that.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Years ago, so he was one of the singers in me ill-fated first line of the Jones lineup of the Joneses. It was him and Candy playing with it. We were kind of doing Brian Auger thing, you know, with Brad Stewart. And, you know, we were trying to do something like that.
Right. I'll come back to Candy Payne actually, because I want to ask you about her, because there's a Weller connection there as well. So this is heliocentric time. So we're talking 2000 time. Presumably this is because of the Ocean Colour Scene boys are suddenly topping the charts and all that, right? Damon Minchella and Craddock. Initially, Craddock's not available. So you get the call to join the band to tour that album.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know how Paul had come across you?
We'd actually heard that someone else in Liverpool had been asked and stupidly knocked it back. A friend of mine kind of got in touch and, you know, said, oh, this guy's available, you know, audition him kind of thing. I suppose I had the stairs diploma that kind of like got me through the door. It was a studio in London somewhere, I'm afraid.
Maybe Nomis or something like that.
Yeah, because he was mixing at the time. So wherever he was mixing, it was just Paul and Whitey around. I'd been sent to a few tunes. One of them was Time and Temperance. I'm not too sure on the others. I think one of them might have been Drinking. Oh. There Is No Drinking After You're Dead. It was all stuff from the current album. You know, I locked it up. I loved it, especially Time and Temperance. I loved that tune. So, yeah, I kind of, it was a labour of love. So, hopefully, I put the work in. Well, I must have done, because I got the job.
And what is a Weller audition like? Presumably, they're not, you know, it's not him and Whitey sat behind a desk with big red buttons like the X Factor. What does it mean?
No, it's just kind of relaxed, you know. You just go in and play and you hope that they're going to be nodding rather than shaking. I mean, noticed some slight nods, so...
I mean, to be fair, Paul does know how to spot a bass player, right? So if you're talking about Bruce Foxen joining the band in whatever that would have been, 74, 73, something like that. And I mean, no pressure. These bass players, you know, people like Camille Hines, Yolanda Childs, Damon Minchella. There's a lot that you're following on from. Did you feel any pressure of coming into a Weller band?
No, I was too stupid to. Sometimes that stupidity protects me.
So this is post Matt Dayton. So Matt's moved on from the Weller band, and Craddock does come back, even though he wasn't initially meant to be part of that tour.
Yes, it was a shame, really. Paul had brought his cousin in, Mark, who was a lovely guy, and it was all going great. We were getting towards the like a week before we went on the road, and just the strangest things just started happening. The lovely guy, I think it was nerves. You know, I didn't notice that, like. You know, one of the strange phenomena I noticed at the time was that he was getting his guitar from the tech and that, and he was banging it out of tune so much, you know, during one song. He must have been, you know, he must have been quantumly affecting the strings with his nervousness, because I've just never seen anyone pull a guitar out of tune so much, you know, in my life. apart from maybe Chad and the Harry Thursdays.
Oh, what a shame. So then he can't take part in the tour.
Yeah, so Steve was brought in last minute to save the day, you know, because obviously he played on the LP and knew the parts. So, because it was very late in the day. He saved the tour, really.
And this was another period where Paul is not digging into the Jam. He's not digging into the Style Council at all. So presumably you didn't play any of that stuff at all at any point with Paul, did you?
No, it wasn't until he did the acoustic tour, really, wasn't it, that he started playing Jam material again?
And you played some pretty big gigs. We're talking like V Festival. There was a trip to Holland, like Pink Pop in Holland as well, as part of that tour.
Yeah, Japan. We nearly went to America twice. There was some kind of kerfuffle with the dates and stuff like that. And America got cancelled a couple of times, which was just a shame. But it was sort of a year and a half.
And some amazing songs around that time as well. I mean, often you'd open the show with either Peacock Suits or Friday Street, songs that you've mentioned there, but things like Dust and Rocks, Back in the Fire, Frightened, which is such an incredible tune. And then we close off often with Loveless and then an encore of Woodcutter's Son. I don't know if these songs are coming back to you in terms of involvement and stuff, but it was a really good. I love that album particularly. I mean, it doesn't get called out as a Weller favourite often on the podcast, but it is brilliant. But what are your memories about that set list?
It springs and he's trying to veer off in a kind of elegant direction. You know, I mean, like he was always throwing a bit of elegance in, you know what I mean, along the way. But that album, especially with getting Robert Kirby into the arrangements and that, it was especially elegant. Like it was, I've been sort of like gagging to make a record like that myself since, but I haven't really had the funding.
So Robert, obviously no longer with us, sadly, passed away in 2009. But famously, best known for his arrangements with Nick Drake, and has worked with people like, you know, Elvis Costello, Elton John, Richard and Linda Thompson, absolute legend. But how did it work? Did you see him? Was he involved in that kind of music direction as part of the live tour?
He conducted the Albert Hall, because that was the only time when we had the strings, and it was an odd day, you know. It was more core anglaise and elbows than horns, the arrangements that he brought to the table, which was lovely. Yeah, so it was only the two Albert Hall gigs. That's right, you know, I just made sure I had as much of them in my monitor as was possible, you know, to hear it all going on. It was a great sense of occasion to that gig. It was fantastic. Because we actually had the man himself there conducting the strings as well. So,
Oh, yeah, incredible. Wow. That would just be, I mean, God, you have to pinch yourself for moments like that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
The great thing about that is it's captured on DVD here. So we have Paul Weller live at the Royal Albert Hall. He's put his glasses on, folks, so you can see. But have you got a copy of that?
I think it's in my mum's. I think my mum's got it.
She loves that one. And I want to talk to you about some of the characters who would have been on the road with you. So you mentioned Whitey. Tell me about Steve White and your relationship with Whitey.
Whitey, lovely geezer. I always feel guilty because, you know, all musicians have got their thing. I'm edgy. I'm quite ahead of the beat. And you know, Steve's really relaxed and kind of almost behind the beat. Yeah, so it wasn't until towards the end of the tenure. I was like, fuck yeah. Oh, shit. And you know, I started just you know, trying to be where he was, really.
You
know,
oh, really? So you changed your style of playing?
I feel like I've been pulling this man forward for 10 months here. I've got to stop doing it, you know. It was just an experience before. Maguire, Sean Payne, loads of people have played with. They were all push forwards, you know. He was very zen about it. He didn't say nothing, you know.
I was going to ask if you flagged it. So he was just seething behind the kit every night.
Yeah, probably.
Have you worked with Steve since? Have you had any connections with Steve since?
No, we haven't. Our paths haven't crossed. They do on Facebook from time to time.
There were these other things that we used to get as well, fans, when you go to a gig around this time, which was the Match Day program, right? This is volume 6. So every tour, you'd get one of these beautiful booklets. This, you know, designed by Simon Halfen, the photography from like Lawrence Watson, absolutely stunning. And you get an interview each time. So this one was Gary Crowley in this one. And then you're called out of the back. Beautiful thing. So we've got Paul Weller, we've got Steve White on drums, Steve Cranick on guitar, Edgar Jones on bass, and Chris Holland on keys. And Chris is coming on the podcast soon, which will be lovely. So tell me about Chris Holland.
Yeah, I saw him a few weeks back, actually. I haven't seen him for donkeys, like, and he was up doing the duels in Liverpool, and a friend of mine, well, one of the guys on the project I'm doing, happened to be tour managing. So, we got together. took a lovely photograph together, you know.
He said that, the two of you were talking about some happy tour memories that he'd completed.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
So those match day programs are lovely. It's all kind of captured. But the other person who's mentioned in there is John Weller. So we must talk about John. What was your relationship with Mr. Weller like? Weller Senior.
John's amazing, man. Just like a tour de force of exactly what he was. My favourite story with John involves money. I don't know what that's right here. Maybe I'll tell you and you chef's choice. I've been told that, you know, where for a week on the tour you got paid weekly for the tour, whatever gigs you did, you got a certain, you know, and I got told it was X amount during the sound check of the first show. I think it was Brixton Academy or something like that, you know, the first show proper. We'd done some warm-ups. He called me over to the side of the stage after sound check. Wager, you all right? Yeah. I was like, yeah, John, found me, how's it going and all that, like, and I've got you. Got you the first week's wages for you. Here's a check. I looked at him and, John, this is actually for double the amount you said, you know. Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I'll let you decide whether
nice. He probably wanted you to then put it into the card team. And did you play cards with John?
No, I just don't play cards, like, you know.
It's a wise move.
I did pick up on that eventually, like, yeah. Some of these kind of like red face ringing the missus up the next morning sometimes, yeah.
It does seem like the only winner in this was mostly John, I think. What about Kenny Wheeler? There's another character on the tour.
Oh, Kenny.
What can you tell us about Ken?
The main thing with Ken really was watching his relationship with Steve Craddock, really. It was like a cartoon, you know what I mean? They were always trying to, I don't know, do each other's sentence or something.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, that's some good gossip. There's some good gossip from you, I can't love it.
Yeah.
So who would have looked after you from a roadie point of view as part of that setup? Can you remember? I mean, I know we're going back over 20 years now, so.
Yeah, it was Roger. Roger, Skeletal Family Roger, yeah.
Oh, he's been on the podcast. Roger's lovely, yeah.
Oh, sound. Yeah. He was really good. He kind of, you know, tried to sort out what deals he could, bonuses and stuff like that. Like, yeah, it was great, Roger.
Now, you mentioned Jules Holland. I was wondering whether I should bring Jules up or not, because hasn't he snubbed you on a couple of occasions? Tell me the story.
It's just a silly thing, really. Every time I've been on the Jules show three or four times, his name checked almost the whole band upset me. But, you know, it was just one of those things. You know what I mean? Yeah, it didn't really offend me until it was the John Lennon tribute, and I was the only Scouser on the program on the John Lennon tribute. So it was like, he's not name checking me, I'm the only Scouser. I'll cry about it. I got over it.
And what was that? You played Instant Karma, I'm guessing. Was that that?
That was a great day out. Steve brought his brother down to get that sort of doubling up effect on the drums and that. Quite a powerhouse. I wish I'd have had another bass player, lad. I needed another bass player that day to meet them on the power front. Like.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, I did at one point, I don't know if I've heard you say or some of the fans say that we didn't think there were recordings outside of that live album, that live DVD. I wasn't really aware of any recordings of you being in the studio, but actually I corrected myself because there was like a Who tribute album that you guys made. Oh, you did a track from. So you did work with
Paul. Yeah, that's right. It was Circles. We went down to Stone. Is it Stone in the Wall? John Entwistle's gaff. Me, Bob Pridden again. I'd met him a few years previous doing demos with another band. It's great because he was like, I don't know, like really old geezer, you know, with the Who and all that, like, and just like nodding behind the desk like a teenager, you know, when we were playing and stuff like that. And just an incredible, he just managed to bring his teenage enthusiasm enthusiasm with him all the way through to the 60s or whatever he was, you know.
That was you, Paul, and Steve White. It's a really tight setup.
Yeah. We just quickly went through circles. I remember I'd just got myself a Mustang and I couldn't really get a very good sound with it. Nah, there must have been another bass knocking out here in John Edwards' fucking house.
You'd have thought he'd have had a few, right? Yeah.
I remember having problems with my bass that I'd just got that day. I underperformed because I wasn't getting it sound out of it. But yeah, it was great to see Bob again. Yeah.
Nice. Now, look, we should talk about how it ended, because actually for Paul, it's quite interesting that the next iteration of a career that's constantly developing, constantly changing, because he does a few acoustic shows that go really well. And then suddenly we're into an 18-month tour of Days of Speed. So your time with the band comes to an end, but presumably not through any kind of proper plan on Paul's part. He just kind of stumbles into these acoustic shows.
Yeah. I mean, there was odd jobs to be done, but, you know, Damon was round the corner. I was up north doing other things and stuff, so it just made sense. It just kind of frizzled.
To be fair, what a tour that was. I mean, I loved those Days of Speed gigs, the acoustic gigs. Did you ever get to see him do any of those?
I did see the Albert Hall one. I don't know if it was the last date or it was very near the end of it, and as we said earlier, Damon and Steve got up with him at the end, done a few jam numbers, and they downrighted Unbroken Stones together or something like that.
Let's talk about your solo career. Well, I say this because there are lots of iterations in terms of bands and lineups and whatever, but ultimately it's you as the driving force. It's always Edgar Jones and something or and somebody. But there's this incredible album, Soothing Music for Stray Cats, which absolutely loved by so many of us, man. What a terrific album. And now available on vinyl as well in recent years as well, which is a lovely thing.
Not many copies left though, you know, so everyone's out there and I think taking the time over it. I've heard from the people that did it that, you know, they're getting to the last dregs of it now, so get them while you can, folks.
Need to be quick.
Because it's got to be licensed from Cherry Red now, so, you know, if someone will have to really have a love to reissue it again, if you know what I mean.
I mean, clearly a very special album for you in terms of as a solo artist kind of, you know, launching that career. But I mentioned how diverse your sound is, how you kind of this chameleon approach that's similar to Mr. Weller as well, because that album takes you off in so many different directions. And I'm guessing that was the intention. It's not one thing, it's lots of things.
Yeah, it was. I guess it was just getting into the double bass. So I was wanting to discover as many avenues as I could on that front. That drove the direction a lot. In the 2 years previous, you know, I'd had this Early Joneses lineup, trying various different amalgamations of that, you know what I mean? With me on Upright sometimes. Or there was also a little period where we were kind of somewhere in between Meters, Dr. John, and Sly Stone, kind of as a easiest way to put it.
Well, you can hear that, is it the song Freedom, which sounds...
It mostly only ended up on the album because I'd been playing with the pianist, Rob Stringer. He'd been my main muse for a couple of years, and he'd had a tendon injury, so he didn't play on anything on Super Music, and I had this previous recording, done some more overdubs on it, and that made it sweet. And it ended up on the album. It's too good to miss, that one. That audio, though, are my favourite moments on the record.
It's one of those things, and I think, you know, for me, it seems that you're clearly an artist who doesn't want to be pigeonholed in a category. I wouldn't know if our price was still such a thing and you were kind of leafing through the categories. I don't know where you'd sit. I'm not sure if you've got a view on it. But also, you seem to, like Paul, you're kind of doing this for yourself first and foremost. And I guess that's true of so many musicians. I mean, that's kind of obvious. But it feels like if people are like it and they're with you for the ride, then that's great. But actually, this is such a personal thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I just love records, you know what I mean? So writing the songs, it's like getting a free record sometimes.
Just happens to be your own.
Records. So I write my own.
Just do it for the vinyl. Am I right in thinking that was recorded on an 8-track from Johnny Marr to go full set?
That's correct. Yeah, it was a little 8-track cassette machine. God knows how you fitted 8-tracks on that, but it did. Yeah, it was a great machine. I've still got it. I haven't used it for a few years because I think I made about 5 or 6 records on it. So it got to a point where it was, you know, I want to do something else, please. You know, this time around, I've got to do that. So maybe we'll discuss some of that later.
Yeah, but that's quite, I mean, that's quite a basic piece of kit to make an album on, I would guess.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like, I only had a number of microphones, you know what I mean? And I left things kind of open. I remember just hearing about how the Night Tripper was recorded, and, you know, obviously it was done in a LA studio, Gold Star or whatever. But one of the interesting things was he got the studio time, but there was something else going on and they weren't allowed to move any of the microphones. They had to place themselves. So it's one of the reasons for the weird sound on the Night Tripper album is that, you know, is the things that a lot of things are off mic and things like that. And I kind of took that approach a little bit. Bass and drums were done live on a song. It was only the double bass that was microphoned, you know, things like that. The drums just bled into the double bass microphone.
Did you talk to Paul about Dr. John at all? Because obviously Taylor in the 90s, he played with him, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I don't know if he talked about him. I just jammed a couple of his tunes or something. His tunes definitely got jammed here and there. Like.
Yeah, and Gilded Splinters had been on the Stanley Road album, hadn't it, at that point as well?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Right, I'm going to talk about a couple of other connections with Weller, and then I want to hear about what's next from your point of view as well, because there was this other connection whereby Concert for Corbin, and I don't know if you'd had much connection with Paul between being part of his band and that, but how did that come about where you got to play on the same lineup as Mr. Weller?
Well, it was through the lovely Lois Wilson, who's always been a helping hand, often pulling me out of a river. my own crap. Lovely gal. And she was very much involved in that, an ardent lefty. I'm an ardent lefty and Paul's an ardent lefty. So, we all never ended up in the same building. Go Corbin, you know.
It was a pretty impressive lineup, wasn't it? So we had like the Farm. Yeah. I mean, Catherine Williams has been on the podcast, Ghetto Priest. Paul playing with Robert Wyatt and Danny Thompson is something that, I mean.
Robert Wyatt was amazing that night. Like, I don't know if you were there or.
No, I wasn't. I don't know why I wasn't. What an idiot. But God, yeah, incredible. I would have loved to have seen that. And why was that not captured on film? My God, incredible.
I didn't realize it wasn't. Of course.
And there's an interesting quote from the organizers as well around this time where they were talking about how music can be such a huge force for social change, and that music helps us kind of stand up for democracy and for fairness and equality and for our basic human rights. So this is the Corbyn message, I guess, or his ethos. It seems like more than ever that is true where we are in 2022. And do you feel that music can make a difference in those kind of things?
Yeah, I think it can. I'm always trying to throw a little bit of that in my words, you know, in lyrics and stuff, but I can. We've got to have Jamie Webster in Liverpool right now.
Yeah, he's doing pretty well, right? Yeah.
He's waving the banner very vigorously. I've been on a thing myself, though, where I'm trying to write protest songs, because I always have a tendency to go humorous with them. I'm trying to write ones with sort of nice firebrand imagery to them, you know what I mean? I've just done me first. It won't be on this record, it'll be on the next. No mail, whatever I was writing about will be all over by the time.
Yeah. We'll be living in a perfect world by then.
I wrote a song protesting about the Germany's invasion of Poland. Hopefully I'll get it out in a few years. You
know? Topical. Now, soon after that gig, we get your next album, which would have been your sixth solo album, I think I'm right in saying, which was The Song of Day and Night on Skeleton Key Records. Yeah. Set up by the Corals, James Skelly, who I'm guessing is a mate of yours as well. But Weller loves that record label too. I don't know if you know this. He's an absolute massive fan of that record label.
Yeah, well, we had the good old Fairway, me old spar Ozzy, Austin Murphy is band the Fairway. That's the gemstone of the Skeleton Key issues, that one. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not, no. I'm going to dig it out straight after this.
Yeah, because it's kind of folky prog, but prog light, it's not, do you know what I mean? I shouldn't really say that word, you know, because it's not really, but, you know, it's not like prog rock, but it is a progressive thing based around folk values. And yeah, it's just really interesting. Jamie was in the Jones as well. He always just like totally blew me away as a guitarist. Ozzy's a great all-rounder, and he teamed up with one of the guys from the singer from the 747s. Just a fantastic album he made. And I think they're planning on making another one now, but they're all dropping kids like rabbits, so I don't know.
Well, there's another label mates on there, Sundowners, who I think are mates of yours as well.
Oh, yeah, I've only just caught up with the fact that they did an album 68 months ago, and I saw news of the repress, and I was like, you're the record, oh, yeah. Catch up on that one. I only heard about it a week ago.
Yeah. And Paul and Steve Pilgrim played on that record with them as well, which is lovely.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they did. I had a look through the sleeve notes and what have you of it, like the notes that, yeah.
So the song A Day and Night, when you're making an album and you've been through this process again with what's coming next, do you go into it with a set idea of what you want to achieve from the start, or do you just kind of see where it takes you?
With that one, I was wanting to get back into the studio when I was avoiding the Porter studio, but James kind of liked the sound of me on the Porter studio, so I carried on with that. I tried doing two of the tracks on it, but sonically the least satisfying on it for me. Sorry, Darren, who's the engineer on them. Yeah, I think he wanted something more like the Viper stuff, but obviously I was progressing again as a writer, sort of like leaning back towards soul music again. I'd been ill for a number of years. I was starting to get my energy back, really. So, you know, and I was wanting to do something that was easier to perform live, not so esoteric, you know. It's like there's a song about a cat, and there's two Spanish instrumentals on it. So, you know, maybe mission wasn't completed there.
The other thing that we've had in recent years as well, and I'm guessing this was a knock-on effect of the break from, you know, COVID and not being able to get out live, and the interest you mentioned, Cherry Red Records. But we have this reflexive look at your career today, you know, like 25 years, the way it is. Oh. And this three CD compilation where you, I mean, there's a huge amount of material there. Was that a fun thing to do, to kind of look back at everything and dig back into the archives?
Yeah, it kind of was. I thought it was brilliantly compiled again by Lois Wilson, who we mentioned earlier, to do with the Corbin concerts, because she made it come across like a compilation, you know. I can be a bit schizophrenic at times, you know, so it's like a one-man nuggets or something, you know, that she's thrown together there for us. So I loved it because I'd done like a track list of myself, but it was just, you know, it was like a bloody discography. Yeah, it was fun going through it all. It was weird, wasn't it? Hardly anything. There was nothing I'd forgotten in there, though. I suppose you work on things for however many months, you know what I mean? You get implanted in your brain there somewhere.
Well, there are things that to you stand out. So if you were to narrow that down to one CD, were there ones that you go, yeah, these are ones that I'm really proud of as songs?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're not looking for a list here, are you?
What are the ones that tick your boxes? So when you kind of go, you know, yes, I've nailed it, there's something I'm really proud of. What is it that ignites within you that makes you feel like I'm onto something here, something special? I can now put it out into the world.
One of the little surprises was a blues thing that I just put together just quickly. It was an idea that I'm sort of knocking around in my head, sort of a little, sort of like vocal thing that I'd knock around in my head, but I've just bought a chromatic harmonica, basically. And I think it's on the sleeve notes of the Cherry Red thing that, you know, I basically broke the harmonica within an hour or two. Like, you know, got it down just in time, and then, oh, this button doesn't work anymore. Can't do that thing anymore. Oh, well. So that was a lot of fun, remembering that one again, because it was just a lowly B-side. It was just a download B-side. So I'd kind of forgotten about that. That was a proud moment here and that again, you know, just something you can knock together in 60 seconds, you know. And I didn't beatbox the drums. It doesn't sound like it, you know, because obviously it's not one of those rhythms.
I didn't know that. Wow, brilliant. I mean, the thing is, where is it you're going to take us next? I mean, what you've been working on a new album. You shared with me, I started this conversation saying about the fact you shared with me a couple of tracks, but these are standalone, like a single, Torture and Lord Give Me the Strength, but separate to an album, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's very much a soul project. A local musician, a real talent. He's kind of an arranger, you know, omni musician. Kind of thing, plays loads of instruments. I mean, like, he's played on this record, he's played drums, piano, well, all various keyboards, done all the horn sections and arranged strings for it. I've heard that he was doing like a Northern Soul style project on his own, you know, sort of like vanity project on his own little label. It just came up in conversation with, I like to do a single, and it went so well and easy, the single. It's not the one you hear today. You know, something else became the lead single later on.
Right.
What was the single is now the first track on the album. It's just a tour de force of a producer. Whenever I've worked with him, it's just his enthusiasm. You know, when you're an MD, a musical director, you know, when you're doing something that's got like 10, 15 people in it, you need someone to... 3 days' work with him, it's like having 2 weeks on a musical holiday. It's great. I love working with Steve. You know, when he said, do you want to come into my studio and record some stuff? It's like, yes, please. So most days we'd get in at 10:30 a.m. listen to a couple of demos. Then he'd be playing the drums and the guitarist. They'd quickly jot down the thing, you know, go straight to the instruments, check the pitfalls, you know what I mean? Or have a run through and find where the pitfalls are. Either way, you know, it was kind of like Elton John in the early 70s speed of making a record. I don't know if you're aware of how fast he used to make in the early 70s. You know, I'm not a big fan, but I really admire how quickly he worked, you know, and it was akin to that, you know, every day we'd be in from like 10 till 6. And we'd always get two rhythms tracks down and the lead vocals and then a few guitar overdubs as well, you know, two, sometimes three songs every time we went in. Aside from when Steve goes in and does the horns on his own, because he works alone of a night, he just gets on with it. He's funny as well. He does silly things like when he's doing the horn section, he'll have a whole row of chairs out, basically blow each horn from a different chair into the same mic. You know, so that it's got the sound of a section kind of thing. So he brings along, right, French horn now.
Just one guy. I love it.
His enthusiasm is unmatched daily in the industry. If anyone was more enthusiastic than him, it'd be a pain in the ass.
In terms of timings then, so when are we out with the single and when's the album? And what's the album called?
There's a track on the album called Reflections of You and Me, and we're playing around with things to do with that. And I just like the word dimension at the moment. So we're playing around with reflections of the soul dimension or reflections of a more soulful dimension or, you know, something along that track. It's a 12-track LP and there'll be a non-LP single full of strings and horns. It's kind of like, you can imagine it's 1966 and Woodstock's happened a year early, but all the guitar bands have died in a plane crash. So all that's left is like Bacharach, Motown and Walker Brothers. So, you know, saying about Paul's more opulent stuff during heliocentric and stuff like that. But I really like them. So I think it gets called Big City Soul within the Northern Soul thing. It's not like the small studios where they're all crammed in and only just about managing to play it in half an hour. It's more like, you know, you soul records that were made by the Beckham crew or in Bell Studios in New York, that kind of thing, you know, where you've got the string arranger, you know what I mean? Or like Lieber and Stoller's stuff on Redbeard, or just that way of making records. It's been forgotten, really. You know, the golden days of the session musician rather than the session musician with 8-gauge guitar strings and he makes this whining noise that you never want to hear again. You know what I mean? Like, talking about, you know, like Tommy Toscolini with flat wound strings and all that. You know what I mean? All those sounds, you know. As we got to make the record, it turned out with me and Steve had quite the knowledge of all those type of people in there. Similarly geeky, and we both love Ellington as well. And Steve can do all that as well. He's got that kind of subtlety in the arrangement, you know what I mean, which I can only dream about, you know. I can write pieces of music that sound good with that on it, but I can't do those kind of arrangements, you know what I mean.
Well, look, this is really exciting. So in terms of timeline, when are we thinking this will be out and available?
Well, the single's mastered. So we've just got to do all the, we're in the midst of doing all the paperwork to get a number for it, you know, so that it goes on the radio, blah, blah. Sorting out our PPL shenanigans. So as soon as that's ready, it's joining the vinyl queue. So I don't know how the vinyl queues are doing at the moment. So I don't know if it makes a difference whether you're putting a single or an album out. So I'm hoping the fact that it's a single, Fleetwood Mac probably aren't the issue in any singles. One of the hold-ups, there was the famous Adele one, and then there was the rumours getting a 50th anniversary thing, as if there aren't enough second-hand copies of that to carpet the planet twice over.
Well, I want to know who's still buying Queen's Greatest Hits on vinyl. How does everybody not have a copy of that now?
I know. I don't even like it. I've got coffee.
It's like still in the top 10. It's mental. Yeah. Oh, well, look, this is really exciting. I'm looking forward to hearing this and keep us up to date, and we'll share all the news on our channels as well. Tell me about the Stairs reunion. So another Stairs reunion just ahead of Christmas, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. A lot of the time it's brought into reality by, you know, someone wanting it to happen, really. Future Yard in the Whittle, great new venue that's opened up over there. Like when Love came to England recently, they actually did 3 nights there, and he did each album.
Oh, wow, cool.
Every night, like, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I got up the first night with them and sang My Flash on You and Softly to Me, which luckily are next to each other on the album and my favourite songs as well. So,
oh, brilliant. Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, a great venue to try and do special things every now and then. So they noticed that they didn't have the Christmas slots filled, so they basically asked us if we were up for it, man. And yeah, of course we were. With Paul being a globe-trotting Icelandic nowadays, it's quite hard to bring us together. So we need that little extra bit of love from the outside to make it gel, make it all work, because we're all idiots with the organisational side of it.
Can you see a world where there'll be more new material from the Stairs?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I've been wanting to prove certain things to myself about certain things, wanting to write certain kind of things, as I say, you know, do some stuff with nice arrangements, you know. I feel like I've got there and I've done it, really. So I have been thinking about, you know, just ploughing through all my garage punk records again, because I think if I did do another Stairs thing, it'd be so easy for us to take the wrong move of going a little bit proggy with it. You know, one of the things I regret we didn't, you know, we did last time around by the Delbets, and it was stuff like that where our hearts were at, really. It was kind of stuff we were listening to. But there was some weird thing inside me as the writer that said, oh, look at all those bands, you've all only ever done one single. You know what I mean? It's better being like the Kinks or the Who, and then you might get to make a few LPs. So it was more towards the British thing. But, I'd love to do some really raucous garage punk, you know, because Paul's the best drummer in the universe for that. When we do cover those songs, it's like you've journeyed into the record because Paul plays the kit on it so boss.
I love it. This has been so lovely, Edgar. I love chatting with you. Thank you so much for joining me. I've got two final questions for you before you go, all right? You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What are you going to go with?
I've always loved Shopping.
Ah, I mentioned that I was going to come back to Candy Payne and I forgot. So
yeah, she did Shopping, didn't she?
Did a version with Paul, right? Yeah.
That's right, yeah. I think Si was a big fan of it. I think it was, you know, something me and Simon Dyne, so United Way On was our love of Shopping, actually.
Nice. So that was, what was that, B-side to Beat Surrender, was that right?
Yeah, it was very late. It was very late in the day, yeah.
And a final question then. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourselves who've had these connections with Paul, whether it's been part of his band or just being big fans, whatever. But it's really for me to get the interview with Paul Weller that I never managed during my radio career. It was my one big regret. If it happens, what should I ask him?
Whoa, that's a difficult one, man. I don't know. I'm just thinking of cheeky things. Like, I know he's got a John Sitar. I'd be like, is it? That's not a question. Can I have your Jones electric guitar sitar, please? I'd love to know where he gets his energy from, though, actually. You know, that was one of the things I noticed, you know, that you can't help but notice when you spend some time in alcohol. He's, I think I likened him before on stage to being like, you know, he prances around like an antelope, but it's like a box, it's like an antelope with boxing gloves on. Paul, where did you get your bloody energy from, mate?
And still, I mean, yeah, you're right. I was watching that Royal Albert Hall gig last night again in prep for this. And I mean, the band were on fire. I mean, it's kind of like almost like Livewood levels of energy.
We were playing the floor at that point, though. We knew what we were doing. We were a month in or so.
And how messy did it get on the tours?
It's gone through a bit of a calm down phase, as I understand, you know, because I was only around for so long, so you only gather things and, you know, inferences. Yeah, there was only really one morning where, I came down to breakfast and I believe some people had been awake all night. I saw Paul kind of, that's why I'm going to party.
I'll go and sit on a different table.
Yeah. That was once, you know what I mean? And, you know, he wasn't nasty or anything. He just looked like he'd been up all night. You know, just looked like he'd been up all night. And that was it. Something had happened that night. I don't know what it was, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Right, yeah, they've gone large. Hey, Edgar, this has been so lovely chatting with you. Good luck for the future, my friend. Keep in touch with what you're doing and the music and all that. And cheers for all that, too. It's always nice to kind of see what you're doing. So thank you so much for joining me, man.
Thank you, Dan. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Yeah, nice one.
My thanks once again to Edgar Jones for joining me on the podcast. Another huge, huge, huge talent. Do check out his solo back catalogue plus The Stairs. More info, videos, ticket details in the show notes for this podcast as well. Just head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com, and you'll find a lovely playlist of music that I've created featuring Edgar on there as well. Now, whilst you're there, you can show your support by heading to my store. We've got exclusive merchandise ready to you in time for Christmas, including our very first official podcast mug. And if you fancy it, you can support the podcast by buying a virtual coffee as well. On the roll call this week for doing exactly that, hello to Ewan, Jen, Howard, Brian, Stephen Cartwright, Stu Burns, hello Stu, hope you're well, Dick Cherry, Colin, Jane the Jam Tart with a Heart, Nick Keane, Mark Zalkman says a huge thanks for your so very entertaining and informative interviews. Well, thank you, Mark. Much appreciated. Simon Grant says, great podcast. Essential listening. Almost as good as the Radio Bristol Early Breakfast Show. I don't know if you were a listener to me back in the day there, Simon. Well, that was a high bar, my friend. And Brian, thanks to you for your virtual coffee as well. Much appreciated to all of you. Thanks for your support. Just head to my website. You can grab a virtual coffee in the store for a shout out next week. And talking of next week, on the next episode of the podcast, an incredible singer and songwriter who will be just days away from the release of his book, One for the Road, The Lives and Lyrics of Simon Fowler and Ocean Colour Scene. Yes, I'm joined by Simon Fowler from Ocean Colour Scene. I cannot wait to share this episode with you. Now make sure you follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple, Spotify, wherever, and you'll find me on social media as well. We're still there on Twitter. We're hanging on at WellerFanPod, or on Instagram and Facebook, just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.